My initiation into the field of civil rights was therefore a hot and a feverish one. It was not easy to change the attitude of a community, but I learned a great deal about the organizational tactics that were necessary to accomplish an objective. I learned that it could not be done by just one group, that it required a coalition. It also took time to build that coalition, and frequently you had to depend on people who were not necessarily with you on all matters of public policy or politics. That surely was the case in Minneapolis. Fortunately, as the mayor of a city, I tried to be the leader of the total of the overall community. My administration was not particularly partisan. I worked closely with the business community, the labor movement, and with groups such as the League of Women Voters, the Citizens League, and others that were essentially interested in improving the quality of our life. My experience as mayor stood me well in the days that were to come in the United States Senate. I have dictated about the Chicago, about the Philadelphia Convention. So let me skip now to what happened to me after I got to the Senate. I've had many people ask me, was your speech at the Philadelphia Convention designed to project you into the public limelight, or was it something that you really believed in? The simple fact is that it was something I believed in and believed in strongly. There was no political plus in it for me, either at home or on the national scene. Surely nationally, it marked me at that time as a dangerous and radical man, as one who had split the Democratic Party. I recall all too well the reception that I received when I came to the Senate. I was looked upon as by some as a menace, by others as a militant, and only by a few as a companion. Harry Truman was president of the United States. He'd been elected in that amazing election of 1948. But no one should delude themselves as to the political complexion or orientation of the Congress. It was not a progressive or liberal body. It was essentially controlled by a coalition of Republicans headed by Robert Taft and Democrats in the Senate headed by Richard Russell. Now, Richard Russell was essentially a constructive man on all matters of foreign policy and domestic issues, with the one exception of the field of civil rights. This is regrettable, because I happen to believe that had Richard Russell's been able to sense the importance of the human rights issue and the passage of constructive civil rights legislation, he might very well have been a genuine candidate for the presidency and may have been elected. He had a tremendous ability, but it was weakened and corroded by his unalterable opposition to the passage of any legislation that would alleviate the plight of the black man in the throughout our nation. He was, in other words, the victim of his region, the victim of a heritage of the past, and unable to break out of the bonds of what was in his time the present day politics. When I think back over that early period, I'm sure that I not fully appreciate the enormity of the task that was ahead of me. To me, civil rights legislation was not just a passing thought or a theme for an article or a Senate speech. It was a firm commitment. I soon was brought to understand in clear and unmistakable fashion that if any success was to be achieved, it would require perseverance, dogged determination, the willingness to absorb a good deal of humiliation and rejection. In other words, not to be included as one of the boys in the Senate Club, at least for some time. I recall all too vividly how the attitude of the media, particularly the print press, the top columnists were surely not sympathetic to civil rights proposals. The leading columnists had already made their peace with the so-called moderates and conservatives. Anyone that came to the Senate and that challenged the status quo was looked upon as either an oddity or a threat. The press was not it was not beneath the press to play off one senator against another, as they often did. It was customary, it was commonplace for them to try to pit Paul Douglas against Hubert Humphrey, or Hubert Humphrey against Estes Kefauver, or to try to breed jealousy between Paul Douglas, Hubert Humphrey, and Herbert Lehman. We were the three that carried the torch, so to speak, for human rights and civil rights legislation. And many times the columns and the columnists with their columns and commentary would try to compare us, and when you added it all, and when you look it over now, and when you would try to compare us, only to pit one against the other, hopefully to arouse the personal animosity and jealousy. It didn't work. The three of us had great respect for each other, and we worked together very closely. It always was a problem to keep our respective staffs from being caught up in the competition that was designed to promote division and jealousy. But we were able to do so. I believe it was because that we were all deeply committed to a greater cause than we were to our respective political, to our individual political well-being. Herbert Lehman came as close to being a giant and a saint as any man I've ever known in politics. He had a richness of experience that none of us could equal. Paul Douglas, with his brilliant mind and his tremendous background in academic life, plus his experience in the city of Chicago, in the politics of the city of Chicago, was another giant of a man. I was most fortunate to be able to gain their confidence and to share in their friendship. I know that I grew in this environment. And despite all the efforts of some to divide us and thereby to weaken the common cause for civil rights, there were the tactic just didn't work. We stayed together and worked together until we were able to achieve our purpose. The first efforts at civil rights legislation, of course, came in the early days of the Truman administration in 1949. Our problem there, as it continued to be for many years afterwards, was how to break the filibuster. The fact of our political life was the coalition and the alliance between the Southern Democrats and the Republican leadership in the Senate. You simply had to know this and thereby be able to measure the possibilities of any success. Richard Russell was a master of the rules of the Senate, and he used those rules with the precision of an engineer. Robert Taft was the leader of the Republicans, and would permit nothing to get in the way to erode or destroy the relationships between the southern wing of the Democratic Party and and the majority of the Republicans in the Senate. When Truman presented the civil rights measures of 1949, there were only a handful of us that were willing to stand up and fight. As I recall, we had approximately 26 to 27 votes, and obviously that was but a pittance. That was little or nothing, as when you stop and think that you needed two-thirds of the Senate, of the total Senate, under the then rules of the Senate, to break a filibuster. President Truman's leader in the Senate on the civil rights issue at that time was J. Howard McGrath, the former Democratic, then the Democratic chairman, then the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and the senator from Rhode Island, who gave strong support to the civil rights efforts, where Senator Irving Eyes, Republican from New York, who was a staunch supporter, as was Charles Toby, the senator from New Hampshire. Senator Toby was truly an independent man. He was a kind of Republican political maverick. And of course, Wayne Morris of Oregon, and Francis Myers of Pennsylvania, and Theodore Francis Green of Rhode Island. These were some of the real leaders in the civil rights field. Frank Graham of North Carolina, a beautiful man, the former president of the University of North Carolina, truly a man of compassion and an honor second to none. Then there were people like H. Alexander Smith of New Jersey, who was more of a moderate, but was willing to help us on the filibuster. Senator Robert Wagner of New York, but he left the Senate in June of 1949. We had others that worked with us, such as Leverett Saltonstall of Massachusetts and Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan, Herbert O'Connor of Maryland. Then there was Alvin Barkley of Taylor, of the candidate for vice president on the progressive ticket with Henry Wallace. He was the senator from Idaho. His term expired in 1951, but he was there in the beginning, as was indeed Claude Pepper of Florida. Claude was one of the driving forces and exhibited great courage. It was not easy for a man from Florida to take the stand that he did. But he did it out of conviction, and he did it brilliantly. There were others, of course, but the real tragedy of the time was to see men of the quality of Lister Hill of Alabama and John Sparkman of the same state, both of them progressive-minded men, but captives of their region and unable to break away from the political necessities of the time in order to preserve their tenure in the Senate. I've never been very critical of men of this quality, because a man like Senator Lister Hill, while he could never support us, while he was never able to support us on civil rights issues, did so much for this country. He more than anyone else was responsible for improvement in health care and for the hospital construction program throughout our country. He was a great force for good in the field of education and all forms of medical and scientific research. His colleague, Senator Sparkman, was the leader in the housing field, including public housing for low-income groups. While these men could not help us in what we call the civil rights legislative battles, they surely were giving of themselves to help improve the lot of the average man, and indeed of those of low income. And in this group were a large number of the people whom we call the minorities, the blacks, the Mexican Americans, the Puerto Ricans, and the poor whites of Appalachia and the rural areas of America. There were many Southerners like this. Take, for example, Carl Hayden, who was never able to support us in breaking a filibuster. Nevertheless, this man quietly and tenaciously worked for and supported a host of legislative proposals designed to strengthen the social and economic fabric of our country. And indeed, this was true of men who were other men who were unable to be who felt it was not possible to be with us on civil rights legislation, but surely did their part when it came to did more than their part. Indeed, were leaders when it came to strengthening such legislative measures as Social Security, the aid to education, hospital construction, the housing programs, employment opportunities. All of these great measures required the help of many who were not who could not qualify as active proponents of civil rights in those early days. I think it should be remembered that while Truman was making tremendous strides in the field of foreign policy, and indeed was the architect of the Marshall Plan, of NATO, of the Greek-Turkish aid program, was giving strong support to the United Nations, was undertaking tremendous initiatives in the area of foreign aid and mutual assistance with friendly countries, that his domestic legislative program was bogged down in the Congress. There just were not the votes for the kind of legislation that that President Truman was proposing. His Senate leader, Scott Lucas, at best was lukewarm to much of the Truman legislation. And the press turned on President Truman very shortly after his great and amazing victory. I've always felt that much of the press just couldn't believe that Truman could be reelected. They were so strongly opposed to him and ridiculed him so much in his early year in the 1948 campaign that despite all their protestations of being willing to eat crow after Truman's amazing victory, that they really set out to undermine him, undermine his programs wherever possible. They latched on to his support of civil rights, and to those of us that were Truman Democrats, and those of us that were Truman Democrats were likewise the subject of journalistic target and editorial criticism. There was just no way that a pro-civil rights liberal could be looked upon as a positive and constructive force in American politics. We were suspect just by the fact that we were willing to press forward on this basic human rights issue. Only time was our ally. Time and the expansion of and the time and events helped prove our case. Wars have often had a very significant impact upon the social order and upon a nation's priorities. Indeed, the Korean War was no exception in this. Our nation became deeply involved in that crucial struggle. There was a mobilization of our manpower again, the call up of the National Guard. And it was at this point that the civil rights issue once again came to the forefront. I recall that some of our National Guard units were being sent into military camps deep in the South. The Minnesota National Guard, for example, was in a camp in Alabama, and immediately it was segregated. We had some members of members in the Guard, and they were segregated in the Southern military installation. The same thing happened to Guard units called up from New York and Michigan, Illinois, and other states. It was at this point that Senator Douglas, Herbert Lehman, and myself, and Senator and myself decided to challenge what was happening in the army relating to related to segregation. We asked for an appointment with General Marshall, who was Secretary of Defense. We were given an appointment with Mrs. Anna Rosenberg, who was the Deputy or Under Secretary of Defense. We met with both the Mrs. Rosenberg and General Marshall and stated our case. We pointed out that the President Truman had commissioned a special study of the pattern of segregation in the armed forces, and that his commission had recommended that it be abolished, and that the President had issued an executive order to that effect. I believe this was known as the Fahey, F-A-H-E-Y, as the Fahey Commission report. We'll check that. We pointed out that our guard units were not segregated, and that we had no intention of permitting them to be segregated simply because they had been called up into national service and were being trained and equipped at military bases in the Deep South. We were reminded we were told during these discussions that Richard Russell was chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and that it would be very, very difficult for the administration to accept to do what we were asking, and at the same time to receive the cooperation of Senator Russell. And I can recall saying very clearly that I too was a United States Senator, and that each of us had one vote. And Herbert Lehman literally pounded the table demanding that the men from New York who were being called up be treated as they were, be treated as American citizens and not be segregated on the basis of race. The same was stated by Paul Douglas. The three of us made it clear that we had to be taken into account, that no longer could the Defense Department and indeed the administration just knuckle under to the demands of certain powerful Southern senators, that while we didn't have as much power as they had in terms of committee chairmanships, that we indeed had a certain amount of nuisance value, that we could cause difficulty, and that we would, that we were not going to stand idly by and permit an executive order of the President to be flaunted, and to and likewise to permit the platform of the Democratic Party to be ignored while a Democrat was in the White House and a Democratic administration was in power. Our firmness on this matter brought some results. It was agreed that if we would not make a public issue of it, that if we would keep our conversations quiet, that the Defense Department would abolish any pattern of segregation anywhere in the armed forces. But we were told by Mrs. Rosenberg and General Marshall and Mrs. Rosenberg that if we were to make an issue of it, that it would become a public issue of it, it would become very difficult. And while the President would undoubtedly enforce the executive order, it would impede the war effort because of the resistance which would come from certain powerful Southern senators, and headed up by Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, chairman of the Armed Services Committee. We agreed that there would be no public protest, that we were not interested in headlines, that we were interested in results. We were also told that Senator Russell would be informed of our insistence and of our position. But again, that we were asked not to press the point with him, but to leave it up to General Marshall. This we did, and to the everlasting credit of Senator Russell and General Marshall, there was no fuss or furor. There was no senatorial rhetoric or demagoguery. The results speak for themselves. The patterns of segregation were set aside, and the United States Army was fully integrated. The Korean War brought about a great advance in civil rights insofar as the armed services were concerned. There was integrated barracks, and the integrated forces, an integrated command. Actually, in many ways, the military was practicing more democracy insofar as equality of opportunity and integration or non-segregation than was the civilian economy. The president stood firm behind his executive order. He was made fully aware of our complaints and of our concerns, and he directed the Secretary of Defense, and he directed and supported the Secretary of Defense in cleaning up this miserable pattern of segregation, which was a hang-on from earlier years. But civil rights is more than legislation guaranteeing equal employment opportunities, desegregation of community facilities, the guarantee of the right to vote, and all the other many civil rights laws which we have passed. The American people, if they are to enjoy what we call equal opportunity and to have equal protection of the laws, must live in a society that is open, that honors and respects character, and that opens the opportunity for people to make something out of their lives. I've always been impressed by the words of a poet of the Depression period, Thomas Wolfe. His words express what I believe is the true purpose of what we call civil rights legislation, and his words truly tell the meaning and the purpose of America. To every man his chance, to every man regardless of his birth, his shining golden opportunity. To every man the right to live, to work, to be himself, and to become whatever thing his manhood and his vision can combine to make him. This is the promise of America. That, in substance, is the meaning of civil rights. And so if we think of civil rights in the broader context, what we're thinking of is the social environment in which our people live. Therefore, legislation in many areas is a part of the overall program of human rights and civil rights. There are no equal employment opportunities when a man is unskilled and competing in the employment market with skilled workers. There is really no freedom for a person that is ignorant and illiterate, and there is very little use to having open public accommodations if you do not have the economic means to even travel or to partake of the many wonders of our country. Therefore, legislation in the field of housing to provide a decent place for every American family, and a decent and safe home for every family, is surely a part of the purpose of our nation and of the human rights to which we are dedicated. Education to the limit of anyone's ability to absorb that education is one of the basic civil rights that every American is entitled to. The right to a job, to gainful employment, to be able to make a contribution to society as well as to sustain oneself, this surely is a civil right. At least it is one that we ought to establish as such a right. The right to travel, to move freely, and to move without restraint, and to live in the place of one's choice. This is a vital right. This is a right for every American. As I see it, we need to establish in our country a basic floor of social justice for every American, no matter where he lives, what his occupation, his economic status, his race or creed or nationality. Those basic minimums or foundations will provide the edifice upon which we can build a better life. But whether a man is black or white, rich or poor, urban or rural, he and his family ought to be entitled to a clean and wholesome environment, clean air, fresh water. He ought to be entitled to be judged not by his race or his economic status, but, as Dr. Martin Luther King put it, by the quality of his character. He ought to have the full and equal protection of the laws, whether he's rich or poor, black or white, or whether he is a naturalized citizen or a native-born citizen. He should be given the opportunity for gainful employment. Hopefully that this employment can be provided by the private sector. But if it cannot, then it is my judgment that the government, federal, state, or local, should provide meaningful work at decent wages. It is a crime to leave people without work when they desire to contribute their labor and whatever skill and talent they have to the common good and also for their own benefit. This is a terrible waste of human resources and one that cannot be justified on basis of morality or economics. Then, too, there are other rights to which every American should be entitled. And that is the right to leisure and recreation. These rights, and many more, are a part of the social fabric, should be a part of the social fabric of our society. And it's to these rights and others like them that I have worked as a senator and as a public official, trying to use the powers of government wherever possible to lead the way to break new ground, but recognizing that government has limitations in what it can do or should do. I've never believed that government ought to provide a life of ease for every citizen, but it ought to provide a way for everyone to make something out of his life. Now, somewhere I have a speech that I gave on a new Bill of Rights for Americans, and I want to incorporate it at this point in my book. I gave this when I made the commencement address at Hamline University. I've used it on other occasions. I shall find it. I also believe that I used it when I addressed the U.S. Naval Academy. So let's look it up and put it in here. My efforts in the United States Senate and during my service as mayor and vice president were directed towards making the promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness more than a declaration of purpose, in fact to be a reality. Life should be much more than sheer existence or survival. It should be filled with the vitality of experience and creation and work and play. Liberty is more than the absence of restraint. It must be defined as removing those obstacles from individual lives so that whatever talent a person has can be brought into fruition or into its fullness. And the pursuit of happiness is indeed a goal for every American. There is no guarantee of happiness, but surely we ought to have the right to pursue it. And this is the right to pursue it. Both government and the individual should combine in partnership to achieve this. I've always looked upon government as a partnership with the people, and the different levels of government to have a partnership between themselves. While it is true that our federal government has expressed and limited duties and responsibilities under our Constitution, it is a vital partner in what we call the federal system. Federalism is cooperation between levels of government with respect for the prerogatives and the limits of each level of government. Federalism is a working partnership between levels of government. It is not to be defined as searching out for ways and means to checkmate the other level, to checkmate one area of government, but rather to find ways and means to bring to bear all of the resources of the different levels of government upon common problems. And I'd like to find some speech that I've delivered on the subject of federalism, the new federalism. Some of my speeches to the mayors and to the local government officials. If I look into this, I think we can find one that will help round out my philosophy on this. What I seek to demonstrate, what I've sought to do in my commitment to civil rights is to think in broader terms than just the abolition of segregation and the fulfillment of integration. I've sought to build public law and public institutions that would provide an opportunity for development and the enrichment of life for each and every citizen. Whenever you discuss civil rights legislation and the problems and the difficulties that we had in achieving it, you have to keep in mind that the major obstacle to all of this, to all civil rights legislation, was what we call Rule 22 of the Senate rules. It was this rule that protected the right of unlimited debate. It was this rule that required originally required two-thirds of all senators on all motions, and on all motions to stop the debate. To stop the unlimited debate. Rule 22 was, in other words, a protection for a minority to be able to exercise their rights for debate until such time as two-thirds of all senators present and voting voted to end the debate and to apply the rule of 1 hour for each senator on the subject matter before the Senate. That rule was modified in the mid-1950s, and that modification was considered to be quite an achievement at the time by some of our senators, but not particularly by myself. I've always believed we ought to be able to legislate in the Senate by majority rule. It was my judgment that what we call a constitutional majority should be able to bring about the end of a filibuster or to close off debate. In other words, 50 plus one would be sufficient to terminate debate. The Constitution makes no provision for two-thirds of the senators to be required to end debate. No legislative body makes such a requirement. The previous question, which is often used in state legislatures, can be moved and voted upon by a simple majority. In other words, those legislative assemblies closest to the people, the state legislatures, do not permit the filibuster, which which under any definition is an undemocratic method and provision in a parliament, in a legislative body. I joined early in my Senate career with Senator Thomas Kuchel, Republican of California, in what we call the majority rule principle to end the filibuster. We sought to change Rule 22 from the two-thirds required to a constitutional majority. There were others who favored a simple majority. I felt that that possibly was not adequate protection of minority, of any minority, because that would have meant that a quorum being a majority, that is 51, that 26 of the 51 theoretically could stop the debate. To me, that would have denied the right of open debate, and surely would have been unfair to any minority that sought to have its point of view heard and given due consideration. We were never able to get a constitutional majority. There were other efforts made to change the Rule 22 by making it 3/5 of the senators present in voting rather than 2/3. That would have reduced the number required to end the filibuster from 66 to 60. That indeed would have been an improvement and would have at least further democratized or liberalized the rules of the Senate. And it would have had a considerable effect, on the passage of controversial legislation such as civil rights. However, it was my view of the Constitution that wherever 2/3 was required for the Congress.
However, it was my view of the Constitution that wherever 2/3 vote of the Congress or the Senate was required, that it was expressly stated in the Constitution, such as in the instance of the conviction of a president under impeachment, or the adoption of a treaty, or the approval of or certain other matters. We can check those out and list them. There was also an explicit understanding that the Congress of the United States was to legislate by majority rule. The Constitution states quite expressly that a majority shall constitute a quorum for the purpose of doing business. Therefore, you can pass in the Congress the most important and controversial legislation, theoretically, by simply a majority of a quorum. A quorum being 51 of the 100 senators, and 26 of the 51 could adopt a major tax bill or could have a declaration of war. Obviously, you would have more than 51 senators under practical circumstances present. But a majority, the rule of majority, is clearly established as the governing principle in a legislative assembly. Therefore, it was my judgment that Rule 22 should provide for what we call a constitutional majority. Now, that was an extra protection over and beyond what some senators thought was desirable. Many senators were of the opinion that a simple majority was sufficient to terminate debate. This, of course, as I've indicated, is the practice that is established in most state legislatures. No state legislature permits a filibuster, nor does any other parliamentary body in a democratic country permit what we call unlimited debate, such as is pretty well guaranteed under the present under Rule 22 of the Senate. The constitutional majority would have meant that 51 senators would be able to terminate debate and bring the issue in question to a decision. And that decision, of course, would then be arrived at by a majority vote, a simple majority vote. Senator Thomas Kuchel of California and myself were the main proponents of the so-called constitutional majority. Senator Wayne Morris and some others were proponents of what we call the simple majority to end debate. We were never able to get our constitutional majority proposal for the change in Senate rules adopted. However, we did press the case year in and year out and built a very impressive record. as to the justification for a change in the in Rule 22. This impressive record also included the arguments of those who felt that a three-fifths majority, or a three-fifths of those present in voting, would be adequate. That, of course, would have, had the three-fifths rule been adopted, which it was not, it would have had a great impact upon the passage of civil rights legislation, because it was quite obvious as years went along that we were getting close to having 60 votes for civil rights legislation. Most of the time we were able to be sure of a majority, so that, or 50 votes, so that we would have been able to adopt civil rights legislation were it not for Rule 22. Rule 22, in other words, stood like a mighty barrier to constructive action by to action by the Congress in the field of civil rights. Rule 22 was the main weapon of those who were opposed to civil rights legislation. Rule 22 is an undemocratic practice. I've never seen any justification for it in legislative history, of parliamentary bodies, or within the Constitution. And when I became Vice President and the presiding officer of the Senate, I ruled on the whole subject of Rule 22, pointing out that I thought it was that I ruled it unconstitutional, that it was my judgment that a constitutional majority was within the framework of the Constitution, and handed down that ruling, only to have it overruled by a decision from the chair in a rather close vote. Nevertheless, a vice president did establish for the precedent by his ruling of declaring the existing Rule 22 as an unconstitutional rule of the Senate, despite the fact that the decision of the chair was appealed and that the appeal overruled the decision of the chair. There is now, in the legislative history relating to Senate rules, a cleared decision by the presiding officer. This will mean that at a later date, someone can look to that ruling and apply it once again, and possibly, after the Senate has been sufficiently educated in the matter of rulemaking, the ruling that I made will be sustained. Now I wish to include a little item about Lyndon Johnson being elected majority leader in 1954. He was our minority leader in 1953 when the Republicans had a majority of one in the Senate. At the time he became minority leader, he asked me to serve on the Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Mansfield had just been elected to the United States Senate, and he was well thought of by Lyndon Johnson, and Mansfield had already earned a considerable reputation as a member of the House of Representatives, and was looked upon as a very knowledgeable person in the field of foreign policy, particularly as it related to the Far East. He was a professor of history at the University of Montana, and also a specialist in matters in Far Eastern politics. Lyndon Johnson and Sam Rayburn were concerned as to what was going to happen now with Eisenhower as president and Dulles as Secretary of State in the field of foreign policy. They were particularly worried about the influence of men like William Noland, who had become the majority leader, and John Bricker, and the more conservative isolationist elements of the Republican Party. Therefore, because of the close division between the Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate, it meant that the Foreign Relations Committee would be divided practically on an equal basis. The committee, I believe, was to have 15 members, 8 Republicans and 7 Democrats, with Senator Alexander Wiley of Wisconsin as the chairman of the committee. The foreign relations and foreign policy were at the very heart of everything transpiring in the 1950s. Republican conservatives were constantly attacking the United Nations, were waging continuous political warfare on the Yalta agreements and the policies of Roosevelt and Harry Truman. Lyndon Johnson and Sam Rayburn wanted to be sure that there were men on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that would be able to meet this onslaught and to hopefully prevent any erosion of American foreign policy and national security as it had been developed in the Roosevelt and Truman years. Also, it is a fact that most of us on the Democratic side were much more sympathetic to Dwight Eisenhower in light of what he had been saying than some of his Republican allies. But we were concerned as to the policies to be pursued by John Foster Dulles and the influence that certain Republicans such as William Nolan and Homer Capehart, William Jenner, Stiles Bridges, and others would have upon Dulles and the administration. So Lyndon Johnson asked me if I would resign from the Committee on Labor and Public Welfare and the Committee on Agriculture and Forestry. This was a very difficult decision for me because my constituency in Minnesota was essentially labor and agriculture. I was a member of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. Our party had its main support from the labor movement and from our people in rural areas, particularly the Farmers Union and many of our cooperatives, such as the Farmers Union Grain Terminal Association, which had a wide membership in Minnesota. Also, there were other farm cooperatives that, such as the Central Exchange and the Midland Cooperative. These were strong political forces in our state. I had become a very active member of the Labor and Public Welfare Committee, committed to repealing the Taft-Hartley Law, was chairman of the Subcommittee on Labor Labor and Management. I was also, for a period of time, chairman of the Health Subcommittee of the Labor and Public Welfare Committee. These were important assignments for me. They were at the very they represented my interest in my main interest in politics at the time. I served on the Committee on Agriculture because I was an avid supporter of high price supports for our farmers and the ever-normal granary plan of storage of farm commodities. The Republican policy was what we call flexible and low price supports, and the Democratic policy was the 90% of parity with crop loans being made available to farmers and storage on the farm and under the supervision and the loan policies of the Commodity Credit Corporation. Minnesota was an important dairy state, and it was important for me to, as a senator from Minnesota, to be on the Committee on Agriculture to watch over, to watch out for, and indeed to fight for the interests of our dairy farmers. Dairy agriculture is expensive. It is has had a high rate of casualties in the sense of farmers being driven out of it by through low prices. So that when Lyndon Johnson asked me to give up those two committees, it was indeed a very difficult decision for me. He talked to me about it and said that I really owed it to the country to do so. He promised me that if I would give up those assignments, that the first opening on the Committee on Agriculture, that I would be given that opportunity, I would be given the opportunity to return. Insofar as the Labor Committee was concerned, as he pointed out, and rightly so, I had a strong labor constituency, and they would be for me and support me whether I was on the committee or not. Furthermore, he knew that I would take a very active part in labor legislation and all legislative matters relating to education and health and labor management policies, which were the under the jurisdiction of the Labor and Public Welfare Committee. I had already spent about 4 years on the Labor and Public Welfare Committee and was well grounded in its work. But I had to give up seniority. I had to give up chairmanships. And believe me, that is quite a sacrifice for a young senator. But I acceded to the minority leader's request, to Senator Lyndon Johnson's request. I did so because I was a strong supporter of NATO, of our program of foreign aid or mutual security. I was deeply concerned over the attacks of the Republicans upon the United Nations and America's participation in United Nations activities. And I felt that I could make a contribution on the Foreign Relations Committee, even though I would enter as with no seniority, enter that committee with no seniority, and be indeed a very junior member. But that's the story of how I got on foreign relations. Within a year, one member of the Senate Committee on Agriculture passed away. It was Senator Clyde Huey, H-U-E-Y, of the state of North Carolina. I immediately went to Lyndon Johnson, who by this time had become the majority leader because of the change of membership in the Senate, and said to Majority Leader Johnson that I now wanted him to redeem his commitment to me of returning to the Committee on Agriculture. I was already a member of the Committee on Government Operations and the Committee on Foreign Relations. Johnson delivered on his promise. He went before the steering committee, which makes committee assignments, and stated the case on my behalf, pointing out that I had given up two important committee assignments in order to fulfill a request of the leadership, and that now I should be given the chance to return to the Committee on Agriculture, which I did. This was important for me to do because of the grave problems facing agriculture, particularly in the Midwest. I went back on that committee and became one of the co-authors of the Food for Peace program, which was one of the most important pieces of legislation adopted in my service, during my service as the United States Senate. I consider that legislation, along with my leadership in the field of civil rights, the sponsorship of the Peace Corps, the co-sponsorship of the National Defense Education Act, and my sponsorship of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, as the most important pieces of legislation of my public career. The Food for Peace program was designed to utilize our agricultural surpluses as a form of economic assistance to the less developed countries of the world. Under this program, literally millions of tons of American grains and millions of pounds of American dairy products and hundreds of thousands of bales of American cotton were used as a form of economic assistance to the developing countries. These commodities saved lives and helped build a better economy. At the same time, they represented the true spirit of the United States, a spirit of sharing and of generosity, a spirit of life-giving rather than life-taking, because Food for Peace saved lives, built lives, helped build countries. It did not take lives nor destroy anything. Well, in 1954, Lyndon Johnson became the majority leader. And after the election of 54, there was, of course, a Democratic caucus, and as to who would be the majority leader. Senator Johnson was not the favorite of some of the more liberal senators. He was looked upon not only his credentials with liberals was marred by the fact that he was from Texas, an oil-producing state, and was a supporter of 27.5% oil depletion allowance. His credentials with liberals was somewhat jaundiced by the fact that he was not the most avid supporter of compulsory civil rights legislation, particularly compulsory fair employment practices. My colleagues, whom I love very much, Paul Douglas and Herbert Lehman, were very suspicious of Lyndon Johnson, feeling that he was a wheeler and dealer, and that he did not fit into what was their conception of a true progressive and liberal senator. I always felt that Lyndon Johnson was not only a pragmatist and a very practical politician with a gift of leadership second to none, but that basically he was a Roosevelt New Deal Democrat. His hero in politics was Franklin Roosevelt. He'd been the administrator of the National Youth Administration in his state. He'd been a congressman during the time of the Roosevelt era, and he had as his political hero Franklin Roosevelt. He was a populist, to say the least, and because of his association with Mexican Americans, he had developed an appreciation of their problems and the injustices which they had to endure. I always felt that Lyndon Johnson was a great deal more liberal than his votes. He, like other Southerners, was often the victim of his environment, of the region in which they lived, of the politics of the day that was a politics of holding down the minorities, of being fearful of the black vote, and of constantly trying to trying to justify forms of segregation as the way of life of the South. Lyndon Johnson was not a Southerner, however. If anything, he was a Westerner. He was a big man, an open man. He never signed the Southern Manifesto. That is that manifesto of so-called constitutional principles that followed after the Little Rock confrontation over school desegregation. He was conspicuous by his absence, by the absence of his signature on that document. This told me that the man was not bound by the symbolism or the constraints of Southern politics. To be sure, he moved cautiously. He maintained his lines of communication and association with men like Senator Russell and Senator Walter George, two powerful men from the state of Georgia. Indeed, Dick Russell was one of his closest friends. But it is now well known that Russell and Johnson disagreed on civil rights legislation, as the majority leader Johnson demonstrated in his sponsorship of the Civil Rights Act of 1957. To be sure, a moderate piece of legislation, but one that was bitterly opposed by the Southern group. Well, Johnson, in his effort to become majority leader following the election of 1954, at which time I had been just reelected from Minnesota, gave me a call on the telephone just prior to the opening of the 83rd Congress. He said to me, he said he'd like to talk to me. He said, "How would you like to be considered for a majority whip?" He'd asked me first if I'd made any decision as to who I was going to support for majority leader. He said he'd heard that some of the liberals were offering a candidate of their own, and that of course he was a candidate for majority leader, and he would surely welcome my support. He said, frankly, I'd like to have you consider being majority whip, the deputy leader. And I had to tell him that I was committed to the nomination of someone else. That those of us in the so-called liberal caucus, liberal group, while we knew we did not have the votes to defeat him, that we had come to the conclusion that it was necessary for some of us to stand up and cast our vote in opposition to him. Well, this was indeed a very costly judgment on my part. Johnson told me over the phone, he said, "Well, you're being a fool, because I can tell you that many of the people..." Johnson proceeded to tell me that many of the senators that were going to vote against him were actually going to vote for him. Now, the simple truth is that we liberals at that time just didn't have very much political sense. We were really mounting what we thought was a vote of protest. Now, votes of protest are generally useless unless you have someone or some object to identify with which to identify. We had, no one that available at the time that could really be elected majority leader. But there is a kind of a fellowship amongst liberals, and sometimes I found that you simply had to stand together because without that solid, without that togetherness, your whole movement splintered and fell apart. I didn't, however, quite understand. I didn't realize how effective Johnson was in actually getting commitments from genuine from senators who had a genuine liberal record. He used the technique of one-on-one. He didn't meet with groups. He met with individuals, and he called into his office every senator one at a time. He was able to offer most of them something that they wanted, because surely the majority leader, by the nature of his position, had a commanding influence in the steering committee, and that committee was the one that made committee assignments. Well, when the new Senate opens, the most important business in the first few days is the assignment of individual senators to committees. And senators will contest for committees with more earnestness in many instances than they will contest about legislation. The committees are all important to them. Many of these committees relate to their constituency. Many of them relate to their interests in legislation. And therefore, when a man like Lyndon Johnson knows he has enough votes to be elected majority leader, it was no trick for him and no real difficulty for him to bleed off, so to speak, a larger number of votes in order to first to reassure his election by an overwhelming majority, and secondly to decimate the opposition. Johnson believed in teaching his opposition a lesson by a massive victory, or should I say by massive assault. Therefore, when we went to the caucus and the votes were cast, and Lyndon Johnson's name was put in nomination, and the name of James Murray, the distinguished senator from Montana, was put in as a token candidate for the Liberals. As I recall, Murray received 13 votes, and Johnson received all of the rest. In fact, Johnson permitted some of the senators that he already had commitments from to cast their vote for Murray so that it just wouldn't look too bad. I immediately rose to declare the nomination unanimous, because I didn't want Senator Murray to get a bad press at home. He had been a very fine and distinguished senator and one of my dearest friends. He was a man of great compassion and great heart, and a true progressive with tremendous courage. And he had served so faithfully throughout the years that it would have been a pity to have had him humiliated by such a miserably low vote. I learned a lesson in that caucus, namely that if you're going to do battle with the giant, you better be ready to, you better be prepared. I also learned that you simply can't follow some of the professional liberals who think, who feel that they're right and are going to proceed regardless of the consequences. Following that election, Lyndon Johnson's election, he called me into his office and said he wanted to see me. And when I came to his office, he said, "Now look, I like you, and you've just made a fool out of yourself. But I think you that you are one of the liberals that has some sense around here. I think you have to keep in mind that Lyndon Johnson knew how to divide the liberals that were against him, or that didn't have faith and trust in him." He then proceeded to tell me that two of my Senate associates that were working with me during the caucus, that were supposed to be active supporters in our liberal group, had actually been meeting with him and had guaranteed Johnson their votes if those votes were needed. And so he said to me, "Now, I don't want you to fool around with those fellows anymore." He said, "Men like Douglas and Lehman are never going to support me. They're real liberals. They're men of conviction. I think they're wrong, and I don't believe that they have any appreciation of my political philosophy. But I don't hold it against them. But there are some of those fellows with whom you're associating," said Lyndon Johnson, "that are not men that don't have the strong commitments and feelings of Douglas and Lehman, and you ought to know it, and you ought to be smart enough to understand it.
He gave me, in other words, a good tongue-lashing as a friend and as a leader. I saw in him leadership that was unmistakable. And then he looked at me and said, "Now, look, I want to deal with you. As far as I am concerned, you're the spokesman for those liberals. I won't talk to anyone else. So if they want a hearing around here, they'll have to get it through you. So you tell them." I told him that I doubted that would go over. One of the problems with liberals was they never wanted a leader. They were all leaders. And that this was the greatest difficulty that we had. But he told me again, he said, "Well, if they're all leaders, they'll get nowhere. So you just appoint yourself as leader and speak for them. Now tell me, who do you people want to serve on some of these key committees?" I told him that it was imperative that we have Paul Douglas on the Committee on Finance. Well, he knew that Paul Douglas was bitterly opposed to the oil industry, and in particular to the excessive depletion allowance. He had known this because Paul Douglas and myself had engaged in debate on the tax bill in 1950, at the time of the Korean War. Paul and I had taken on Walter George, who was chairman of the Finance Committee at the time, and Eugene Milliken, the ranking Republican member. Johnson had witnessed that, and he knew what our views were on taxation, and they were considerably different, at least in the oil industry, than that of Lyndon Johnson. But he said, Johnson said to me, "If you want Douglas, I'll recommend him to the steering committee, and I'll do my damnedest to see that he's appointed. Now, who else do you have in mind?" And I said, "Well, we surely want Herbert Lehman to be on the Committee on the Judiciary." He said, "I'll do my damnedest to get that. I'm not sure I can make it." And I said, "Well, finally, and we want somebody on the policy committee." And he said, "Well, who do you want?" At that time, I should have recommended myself. Really, I wanted to. But I felt we owed Jim Murray something. So I said, "We want Senator James Murray of Montana." He said, "Well, that just proves once again that you liberals don't understand politics." He said, "I'll put him on because that's your request." But he said, "Damn it, you ought to put somebody on that's younger, that is more forceful, and that can speak up for your point of view. But the trouble with you liberals is you're soft-headed and soft-hearted. It's good enough to be soft-hearted, and sometimes it's all right to be soft-headed, but you ought never to be guilty of both at the same time. I've never forgotten it." Jim Murray was put on the policy committee. And he then said to me, "And as far as you, Hubert, we'll put you on the steering committee. And that'll give you a chance to watch over these nominations from here on out. In the meantime, I want to work with you. I want you to act as a sort of a deputy whip. I'll be in touch. I'll work with you and give you assignments from time to time." That was the beginning of my close relationship with Lyndon Johnson, a relationship that started with a scolding, that ended with lessons well learned, and that started with the scolding, that continued with lessons to be learned, and developed and was enriched by a sense of confidence that both of us had in each other. I want to do a few biographies, so to speak, a brief scenario or story about some unforgettable characters that I've known during my service in the Senate and as a vice president. I want to start with Alban Barkley. Alban Barkley is to me the all-American politician. I use that all-encompassing terminology because he represented to me the true story of American political life. He was a distinguished and he was an accomplished legislator. He was the majority leader of the United States Senate during the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt. He was vice president of the United States during the presidency of Harry Truman. He was a member of the House of Representatives when he first came into national politics. He was one of three immortals in. Are three greats, as I knew them. He, Sam Rayburn, and Carl Hayden
all came to the Congress at the same time as a result of the election of 1912. All three served with complete and total integrity and great honor to them, to their country, the Congress, their political party, and themselves. All three were remarkable legislators and men of great influence and outstanding ability. But Alvin Barkley stands out as a man who really enjoyed politics. To him, politics was, as John Adams put it, a spirit of public happiness. He was close to the American people. He understood their weaknesses and their strengths. He was filled with yarns and stories that had an element of truth in them and therefore made them all the more humorous and telling. He understood the political process in every aspect, from the point of a campaign up to the achievement of high public office. He was a master in the field of legislation. He was tremendously loyal to his party and to the president that he served. He was a man of great wit and basic intelligence. But above all, he had the touch of the ordinary man on the one hand, but with the talent and a bit of genius when it came to campaigning and to politics. I first got to know Alvin Barkley when he was a candidate for the vice presidency with Harry Truman. I heard him speak at the Democratic Convention in 1948. I saw the dedication and devotion of so many of his followers. He was being given serious consideration then as a candidate for president. I, of course, had heard a great deal about him as a Roosevelt Democrat, a leader in the New Deal. But my personal acquaintanceship with him started in the summer of 1948 at Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. He made a remarkable speech there, and one that left a tremendous impact upon a divided and worried political party. The Democrats were down on their luck, so to speak. They were not at all sure that they wanted Harry Truman for president as their candidate for president. The party was divided, but more importantly, it was disconsolate. The Republican attack had been ferocious during those post-war years, and it had taken its toll in terms of public support for the Democratic Party and its candidates. It was at that convention that Alvin Barkley rallied, that Alvin Barkley helped lift the spirits of the delegates, and indeed of the entire Democratic Party. He had that combination of both of partisanship, basic sound philosophy, and native wit that made him an extraordinarily able and persuasive platform speaker. He was an orator second to none. His mind was filled with the history of the Democratic Party and of the legislative accomplishments of Democrats from the time of Woodrow Wilson up to the present.
He thoroughly enjoyed campaigning. He liked to speak. And that sense of enjoyment in speaking came through in his message. He could be a terrific part. He could make a partisan speech second to none. And at the same time, he had a host of friends in the Republican Party. Above everything else, he was an American, and a true American politician, and an American who had faith in the country. He was an optimist about the future of the country. He was a philosopher about our people, our heritage, and our destiny. But I liked him above all because he was able to communicate so well with the audiences to the audiences that he addressed, just as he was able to communicate individually as we sat and visited from time to time. When I became Vice President of the United States, I had a portrait of Alvin Barkley in my office. I remember when his daughter came to visit me one time, and she was so pleased to see that her father's portrait was in the reception room of the Vice President's office. I told her that's exactly where it belonged, because to me, he was the Veep. He was called that title, Veep, was given to him as an expression of affection from the press corps and from those who knew him so well. Well, as I said, I first met him in 1948 at Philadelphia, and then later on in the campaign of that year. He came to Minnesota, and he campaigned with me in that crucial election. He spoke at Rochester, Minnesota, and I recall how well he was able to relate to the issues that were important to our people. The issues of the post-war period, of foreign policy, the need of America to take the role of leadership in binding up the wounds, of sharing of our abundance and of our wealth and of our substance to help those who had been the victims of war. But also, he got right down to the local issues, the problems that confronted our farmers, the needs of our workers, and was able to project the message of the Truman administration with such clarity and persuasiveness. Alvin Barkley had a rule of never speaking unkindly or in derogatory terms about any United States senator, even of the opposite party. He came to Minnesota in 1948, and Senator Joseph Ball was the Republican incumbent. I was contesting Senator Ball in that election. Ball had supported Roosevelt in 1944, at the time that Alvin Barkley was majority leader in the Senate. Obviously, Alvin Barkley owed him a debt of gratitude, as it did indeed the entire Roosevelt administration. Ball had been very helpful to Roosevelt and was an internationalist. He had joined in what was known as the B2H2 resolution, the Burton and Ball and the Hill and Hatch resolution that called for the establishment of an international organization to ensure world peace. This was a very important resolution and had commanded considerable amount of public attention. It was also also endorsed by President Truman. I believe that Ball and Barkley both had served on the Truman Committee during the crucial years of the war, during the war years. It was the Truman Investigating Committee that was keeping a close watch on what was developing and what was going on in war production checking into the abuses and extravagances and wastes that so inevitably occur in wartime. So that Senator Ball had many friends in the Democratic Party. This placed Alvin Barkley in a rather difficult position when he came into Minnesota to campaign for the Democratic nominee for president, Mr. Truman, and to campaign and to speak in my behalf as the Democratic candidate for Senate. Well, when he was asked by the newsmen what his views were of Senator Ball and how he could be out there supporting me in light of the kind and in light of the many good things that he had said about Senator Ball in earlier years, he answered the query by telling the story, which was the way that he often responded to a question from the press. I remember that story because it seemed to fit our political environment. After all, Minnesota is noted for the large number of Scandinavians in its population. So Alvin Barkley said, "Well, now, boys, let me tell you about Senator Ball." He said, "It is true that I have said in the past many good things about him, all of which he richly deserved. But," he said, "he reminds me of the story about a Scandinavian family out here in Minnesota. The old man, the head of the family, passed away one day, and lo and behold, the family woke up, the family discovered that there had never been a photograph taken of the old man, They wanted some kind of a photograph or picture to remember him by. So they called in an artist and talked with him to see whether or not this artist might be able to paint a likeness of the old gent. The family described to the artist all about their deceased father and husband. They told about his habits. They described his physical makeup. They told everything they could about how he walked, how he stood, how tall he was, how much he weighed, the color of his hair, and all the physical and described all of his physical qualities. The artist went back to his studio with this detailed description and proceeded to do the painting. Some months later, he came back with his finished product, and there was the unveiling. The oldest son called the family together, and as Alvin Barkley said, "Ole," the oldest son, called all of the folks together in the living room, and the artist, and he told the family, he said, "We are going to have the painting of the old man." The artist proceeded to unveil the painting, and the entire family stood around and looked at it for a long period of time. But Ole took a special look. He looked from the side, and then he went to the other side and peered at it. He stood on a chair, and he looked down at it. He backed off towards the end of the room, and he looked at it. He got down on his knees, and he looked up at it. Then he pulled back a few paces, and he stood and stared at it. And the artist was becoming ever more concerned. The artist finally said, "Well," he said, "Ole, what do you think?" He said, "Isn't this the likeness of your father?" And Ole looked at the artist and then looked at the portrait. He says, "Yeah," he says, "that's the old man, all right." He says, "But my God, how he has changed." And at that point, Alvin Barkley said, "Well," he said, "that's Senator Ball, all right, and the one that you talked to me about, but my, how he has changed." And with that cute little story, and then using the Scandinavian accent, bringing in Scandinavian names in Minnesota, he was able to disassociate himself for the purposes of that campaign from the
from the glowing tributes that he had given to Senator Ball in earlier years. He simply put it out that once it was that he simply made it clear that Senator Ball had changed. And indeed he had. He had become a very severe critic of the Roosevelt administration. He'd become a very conservative man after having been quite liberal. He had joined with Robert Taft and had become and was much less of an internationalist. And obviously Senator Ball had suffered a good deal from the disciplinary action and criticism of his Republican colleagues. And he was trying to get himself back into the good graces of the Republican leadership. In so doing, he had backed away from much of what he had stood for in the early 1940s. And it was to this that Alvin Barkley was referring, cleverly and indirectly, by that statement. "Yes, it's the old man, all right," said Ole, "but my, how he has changed." And that was the way that Barkley identified Joe Ball. Well, Barkley traveled all over southern Minnesota with me, speaking at meetings. I remember us, he traveled in a DC-3 airplane, and we landed at airports that were far too small, that had far too short a runway to accommodate the plane, but Barkley never worried. There were no great crowds at the airports. He went to any meeting regardless of size. And everyone he entertained and educated. He was the perfect showman. He was the gentle philosopher. He was the thundering partisan. He was the persuasive advocate of the Roosevelt-Truman policies. He was above all an all-American politician, and to me, a statesman. Barkley's vice presidency was an active one. Of course, I was not one of the intimates in the presidential circle, but we did get to see Barkley a great deal in the Senate. He helped to ease the tensions. He gave some of us younger members and newer members of the Senate assignments that were helpful, and he made some rulings that were of great significance. I recall, for example, that when it came to a critical decision on housing legislation that had been passed, a bill passed by the House and one by the Senate, that Alvin Barkley, as Vice President, instead of just accepting the routine listing of names for members of the conference committee, appointed those members which he thought would carry out the intent and the spirit of the Senate vote. A little background on this might be helpful. When the two houses have worked their will on any piece of legislation, there are frequently great differences between the bill as passed by the House and the one adopted by the Senate. These differences are ironed out by what is known as a conference committee. This committee consists of members from the House of Representatives and members from the Senate. The members representing each of the bodies are chosen from the committee that has processed the bill. For example, in the Senate, housing legislation was processed or came from the Banking and Currency Committee, now known as the Committee on Banking and Housing and Urban Development. The same legislation came from the Commerce Committee in the House of Representatives. Tradition has dictated that the members of the conference committee are the senior members based on seniority from each of the respective committees.
Therefore, if there are to be, let's say, 7 members from the House on the conference committee, and there is a Democratic majority on that committee, you would generally have 4 senior Democrats and the 3 senior Republicans. In the Senate, it would be the same. Well, all too often, the senior members, particularly in the Truman years, were not always sympathetic to the decision made by the Senate. Senior members would sometimes be those who had voted against the bill or against important amendments that had been added to the bill as a result of floor debate or as a result of debate in the Senate. Therefore, it is not unusual for a conference committee to come back with a final piece of legislation that has compromised a great deal final piece of legislation that has excluded from the text of the legislation important amendments added as a result of debate and votes in the Senate or the House. You have to keep in mind that the Congress, that the 81st and 82nd Congress were not particularly sympathetic to some of the proposals made by President Truman. When legislation was adopted, at best it was a compromise, and then if you went to conference with members of the conference committee being conservative or opposed to the legislation, you often had a bill that came back from conference that was substantially watered down. Well, this has been, for years Congress had put up with this, and it was just tradition and precedent that those who served on the conference committee would be those senior members. Alvin Barkley, as vice president, ruled that this was not in the spirit of the rules of the Senate, nor was it necessary for the rule of seniority to be applied. As a matter of fact, he ruled that it was necessary that the majority of the conferees be those who were in support of the legislation as adopted by either House, as adopted by the Senate. This was a very significant ruling, and it just demonstrated the independence that Alvin Barkley had and also his dedication to the will of the Senate and his dedication and respect for the will of the Senate, as well as his dedication to the program advanced by the President and the party. I recall that it was Alvin Barkley that gave me my first overseas assignment. That was in 1951. As a senator, I had not been privileged to travel abroad. There was a list of senators that was selected at the suggestion and nomination of the majority leader, then Scott Lucas, Senator Scott Lucas, to attend a conference in Bonn, Germany, and subsequently to go to Vienna, Austria. As I said, this was in the fall of 1951. I was not on that list. My good and dear friend, William Benton, senator from Connecticut, who had known Alvin Barkley for some time, went up to speak to him and suggested that I be added. Without any hesitation, Vice President Barkley announced my name, despite the fact that I had not been suggested or nominated by the majority leader. the majority leader had not forgiven me for my activities at the Philadelphia Convention in 1948, when I opposed Senator Lucas on the civil rights plank. Later on, Senator Lucas and I became good friends. But in those first two or three years in the Senate, it was anything, the relationships were proper, but not friendly or warm. Vice President Barkley gave me that early opportunity to participate in an international conference to broaden my understanding and knowledge of world events and affairs by that most interesting and informative trip to Bonn, Germany, and to Vienna. At that time, our relationships with Germany were that of an occupying power, and our commissioner in Bonn was John McCloy. Our commissioner in Vienna, we were a member of an international consortium for the control of Austria, the Soviet Union, Britain, France, and the United States. The opportunity to see how to the opportunity to visit Germany and Austria in 1951 was a rare privilege indeed. I was able to see the devastation along the Rhine, the bombed out cities of Cologne and Stuttgart and Dusseldorf. The chairman of our Senate group was Theodore Francis Green, member of the Foreign Relations Committee. I recall our visit to Austria. We arrived at the time that the Soviet Union was in charge for 30 days. Every 30 days, the control changed from one country to another. These are experiences that I shall never forget. For the first time in my life, I saw Soviet soldiers and officers. I saw them at the airport as we landed in Vienna. And yet I also remember seeing the American flag and hearing the Star Spangled Banner as we alighted from our little DC-3 airplane, having come down through a safe air corridor from Bonn to Vienna. Yes, indeed, the air itself was divided between the military powers, and we had to stay within that safe air corridor or be in danger of being intercepted by Soviet aircraft. I recall alighting. I recall stepping out of that airplane and the tremendous emotional feeling that I had as I witnessed, on the one hand, Soviet soldiers standing at attention along the runway, along the apron of the runway, seeing the Austrian police, seeing the hammer and sickle flag, indicating that the Soviets were in command at the time of our arrival, and yet at the same time seeing the American flag that had been raised because of the arrival of a group of United States senators, and hearing over the loudspeaker the Star Spangled Banner. And then there was a reception group of American servicemen, most of them several from the Air Force and others from the U.S. Army. an overwhelming feeling of patriotic emotion gripped me as I walked down that narrow path, as I walked down that pathway to the air terminal. Well, it was Alvin Barkley that gave me that opportunity. I can't forget it. Later on, when I asked to be appointed to the Senate Select Committee on Small Business, dash a very important committee, as particularly as it related to the business constituency in Minnesota, I went to Alvin Barkley and asked to be appointed. He took up my case with the leadership. I had not been recommended by the leadership, but Alvin Barkley saw to it that I was given the chance to serve. I served on that committee for many years, conducting important hearings and being given the opportunity of additional service to the people of Minnesota. Yes, I remember Alvin Barkley in those vice presidential years of his as the goodwill ambassador of the United States. I recall reading of his journey to Berlin and how he and Bob Hope went to Berlin at the Christmas time to entertain and to speak to and to entertain the American troops. Alvin Barkley was the spokesman for the administration and the Democratic Party in the elections of 1950, and indeed again in 1952. During those years of his vice presidency, he remarried after having lost his wife and married a beautiful lady from St. Louis. I should get her name in here. It was a love affair reported worldwide. And really it was a love affair, a true love affair that touched the heart of the American people. Here was a man in his 70s, married to a woman in her late 40s. It was a time when those who were along in years took heart from the took heart and had a revived and rejuvenated spirit by the fact of Alvin Barkley's romance. He literally exuded goodwill, joy, and happiness at a time of tension and strife, and danger. And all of us that had the opportunity to know him were strengthened by his wisdom, were benefited by his wisdom, his knowledge of American political life, and his example of good citizenship. What a remarkable man. That's why I call him the all-American politician. This man was so unpretentious. I recall one evening that we were having dinner over at Nelson Rockefeller's beautiful home in Rock Creek Park, just back of the Shoreham Hotel. It was a dinner at which Nelson Rockefeller was entertaining some of the members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I was the last one to arrive. Mrs. Humphrey and I were the last to arrive, and I think I should tell you why. I had been left at the Foreign Relations Committee to conclude the hearings of the day. Quite frankly, at the time, I thought it was an honor, quite an honor, to be entrusted with that responsibility. I noticed that as the hours went on, one by one, the senators, Republican and Democrat alike,
would believe were leaving the committee room. At about 5 o'clock, as I concluded the hearings with a long list of witnesses having testified, I found that I was all alone. All other senators had departed. I knew that Mrs. Humphrey and I were to attend a dinner that evening at the Nelson Rockefeller home. I rushed out to our home at North Chevy Chase, a good distance from the Capitol building, to change our to dress and to pick up Mrs. Humphrey. And by the time that I had dressed and pick up Mrs. Humphrey, by the time that we arrived at the Nelson Rockefeller home, we were slightly late, and all other senators had, and all other guests had obviously been there for some time. When I came into the room, when I came out to the garden where Mr. Rockefeller was visiting and visiting with and entertaining his guests, lo and behold, I saw the entire membership of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. They had left me as the cleanup man for that long list of witnesses. Each and every one of them, a long list of witnesses, each of them joshed me along the way about being late, and then proceeded to tell the Vice President, Mr. Barkley, Senator Alvin Barkley, that they'd left their friend Hubert Humphrey holding the bag, so to speak, to listen to the last witness while they had quietly departed and prepared themselves for the evening. I told the Vice President that I'd never handled a bill quite so big, that it ran into the billions, and I wondered how in the world we were ever going to pay for it. And he then went on to tell another one of his great stories, and this time it was about Daniel Webster and Theodore Francis Green. Senator Green, having been chairman of the committee and being a very rich man and also known for his rather tight-fisted ways, he told the story about Daniel Webster, who occasionally would enjoy a little extra of the spiritus frumenti. In other words, good bourbon, and as Alvin Barkley put it, good Kentucky bourbon. And Barkley was, and Webster was making a speech, and it went on and on. And every time that he'd stop for a moment, someone from the audience would say something, and at that point, Webster would pick up the speech and continue to talk. He said that Webster started out talking about public lands. And as he went on out talking about the public lands, why, somebody mentioned the Indians. Somebody hollered from the audience, "Tell us about the Indians." And then Webster would talk for another half hour about the Indians. Then someone would holler at Webster, "Tell us about the canals." And he'd talk for another half hour about the canals. And then he'd go on. I got to remember this stuff. Let's see. Someone said, "Senator, tell us about the public debt. And who's going to pay for it?" And at this point, according to the Barkley story, Daniel Webster said, "Just give me a check, and I'll sign it." At this, Barkley turned this story on Theodore Francis Green, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He said, "Hubert, don't worry about the size of that foreign aid bill. All you need to do is to give Theodore Francis Green a check, get him to sign it. He's got enough money to pay for it." It was just another indication of how this remarkable man, in his jocular and witty manner, would use a story to make a point. He was simply indicating that Theodore Francis Green was a mighty rich fellow,
but tight as the bark on a tree. I recall that after that dinner, Mrs. Humphrey and I gave Alvin Barkley a ride home in our car. Here was the Vice President of the United States, with no Secret Service, with no chauffeured limousine, living in an apartment on Connecticut Avenue, being just plain Mr. America with his lovely wife and bride, enjoying American life, and indeed the dean of American politics. What a privilege it was just to share his company and to be known as his friend. In the election of 1954, Barkley was re-elected to the United States Senate, defeating John Sherman Cooper, a remarkable John Sherman Cooper of Kentucky, the Republican senator. Senator Cooper is a truly decent and great man himself, and went on to have an even greater and more illustrious career. But Barkley was reelected by his friends, by his fellow citizens in Kentucky, and he came back to the Senate to start serving in January of 1955. I had the privilege of sitting next to him in the Senate, in the back row of the Senate, and I visited with him many, many times. He told me of his deep commitment to the field, to the area of civil rights legislation. I recall his tremendous, one of his great speeches at the Armory in Washington. He was the one speaker above all others that could lift an audience and make you proud to be a Democrat and at the same time proud to be an American. He was called upon to speak everywhere, and he gave him himself enthusiastically and generously. He served on the Committee on Foreign Relations, and I was privileged to serve with him on that important committee. And as history now records, he was addressing an audience of young people at a college, at a school, when he collapsed in the middle of a speech, when he collapsed in the delivery of his speech. As they would say, he died with his boots on. Indeed, he passed away doing what he liked to do and doing what he could best do, inspiring an audience, giving hope and faith to the young, and conducting himself and living a life of public service that was characterized by integrity, responsibility, honor, and loyalty. That's my kind of a man. One of the other greats of the United States Senate during my service there was Carl Hayden, the senior senator from Arizona. Senator Hayden, like Sam Rayburn and Alvin Barkley, had come to the Congress as a result of the election of 1912. His first term was in the House of Representatives. When Arizona became a state, he represented the state of Arizona in the United States Senate. Carl Hayden's life story is truly an American saga. He was of the West and lived the life of the open country. He was a sheriff out in Arizona before it was a state. He helped mold the political life of the territory and then the state. His whole political career was synonymous with the statehood of Arizona, its growth and development. I got to know him, of course, later in his life. By this time, he was one of the leading United States senators and highly respected by all of his colleagues. I can remember when I spoke to President Truman and asked him for some advice as to how I could best conduct myself and how I should conduct myself in the Senate. And he said to me, the man to watch and the man to pattern your Senate career after is Carl Hayden. He's a worker. He takes care of the duties of a senator. He fulfills his committee assignments. He doesn't say too much, but he gets a lot done. President Truman had the highest regard for Senator Hayden. I soon found out after coming to the Senate that not only did the president speak well of him, but all of his colleagues looked upon him as a remarkable man and indeed a statesman. Of course, Senator Hayden was deeply interested in the development of the West and particularly the Southwest. He was a leader in every program for public works in that great part of America, for irrigation, land reclamation, and for the economic development of the sparsely settled lands of the Rocky Mountain states and the Southwest. His main interest and dedication was to what is known as the Central Arizona Project. This particular vast public works program of flood control, of dams, of irrigation was criticized and condemned by many as being an extravagance and uneconomic. In other words, the Eastern press, and indeed many of the senators and representatives of the East and of the Midwest, looked upon the Central Arizona Project as a wasteful use of money that would yield very little economic benefit to the nation, and that the costs were out of proportion to what benefits it would bring, even to the area that it was to affect. Carl Hayden pushed this program day in and day out, quietly, carefully, methodically. I recall that he occupied a number of rooms in the west wing of the Capitol, in the west front of the Capitol. It was there that the Central Arizona Project was planned and developed. Of course, Senator Hayden, with his position of with his powerful position on the Senate Appropriations Committee, had many so-called do bills, D-U-E-B-I-L-L-S in quotes, from a number of senators. After the demise of Senator Kenneth McKellar of Tennessee, who was chairman of the Appropriations Committee when I arrived in the Senate, Carl Hayden became the chairman. And in that powerful position of chairman of the Appropriations Committee, he was able to carefully and methodically develop support for his Central Arizona project. You have to understand that the chairman of the Appropriations Committee can do many things for his colleagues. And while there's seldom what we call a quid pro quo, that is, if I do something for you, you are pledged to do something for me, there is a sort of a gentleman's understanding that if you ask a special favor, or if you ask for consideration from the chairman of the Appropriations Committee for some project that may benefit your state, or your area, that later on you may be called upon, either directly or indirectly, to support a program for the chairman. This is what they call log rolling in the editorials. But in truth, it generally works out to be a benefit to the whole country. I have always supported the developmental programs of the Rocky Mountain states, the West and the Southwest, just as I've supported the flood control projects in the Deep South. To me, the United States is one economic entity. And while I am a senator from Minnesota, I am above all a United States senator. And therefore, it was no particular problem to me to support the Central Arizona Project, even though I took a great deal of editorial criticism in my home state. I have never agreed with those that felt that the public works programs, the hydroelectric dams, the flood control projects, the dredging of rivers, the deepening of harbors, the building of irrigation works, was a wasteful expenditure of public funds. In truth, the great western areas of America would not be making the contribution to our national life that they are today were it not for these vast public works programs that had been authorized by the Congress and for which appropriations had been made. Carl Hayden was indeed one of the leaders in the economic development of the Rocky Mountain and western states. So that when the time came for a vote on his Central Arizona project, it carried, and I was proud to have cast my vote for it. That program will do a great deal, that project will do a great deal to strengthen the economic fabric of Arizona, New Mexico, and southern Colorado, and other areas of the West and Southwest. It's very difficult to prove that what the economic benefit, it's very difficult to prove the cost-benefit ratio, as they say, or as they call it. But this I know, that if the western states are to be populated, if they're to make their contribution to the national economy, they must have water, and they must have power. The deserts must be made to bloom. And indeed, through the irrigation systems that is taking place.